I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 8th of April. Our guest this hour has written about an issue that, you know, I read it and I thought, I had no idea that we depended on the Soviet Union, on Russia, for a lot of what goes on in our space program. So that's why we do shows like this, because we learn a lot. She's the author of a piece that appears in Salon, How Russia Could Strangle the U.S. Space Program if you use a cell phone, have a GPS system in your car, or get cash from ATMs. You should be worried. You think that Russia has no way to put pressure on the United States? Think again. Our guest is the author of that piece, and she has a very, very interesting background. She has been a correspondent in Afghanistan for quite some time, and she forged a reputation as an analyst and commentator while working for the Institute for War and Peace in Kabul. She is a senior correspondent for Global Post. She has done projects with NPR, Canadian Broadcasting, CNN, the Australian Broadcasting Corporation. She spent nearly 2 years in Helmand Province, where she covered the Taliban insurgency as well as the poppy industry. Spent more than a decade before that in Moscow, where she worked for a variety of newspapers and began her career as a journalist with the Moscow Times, branching out to work for the Christian Science Monitor, Newsday, and the Boston Globe. We will start with, of course, the article that she wrote, but as you heard from the news on NPR just a few minutes ago, there is also news coming out of Ukraine with riot police and other Ukrainian forces cracking down on pro-Russian demonstrators in eastern Ukraine, and a warning from Russia that alleged an American military contractor is helping Ukraine. So we'll ask for her response on that as well. For you to join this conversation, our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter at K Dunn Show. Jean, thank you very much for being with us.
It's a pleasure to be with you, Kathleen.
You know, Jean, this is something I must tell you I had never thought of. I had no idea how dependent we are on Russia for our space program and for, as you say, a lot of things that we take for granted that we use every day in this country. Can you tell me a little bit about the history of this, when it happened and why?
Well, what has happened is that we have forged a partnership with Russia in several areas over the past two decades. In the 90s, when everything was crashing down, the United States started a lot of programs to work with Russian scientists, both to keep them from being tempted to peddle their skills in less desirable locales, and also for us to be able to acquire some know-how and technology. Things were quite economical for us in the 90s because Russia was just falling apart.
Mm-hmm.
And what happened is Lockheed and Boeing forged a partnership with an enterprise outside of Moscow that makes rocket engines. And according to multiple sources, these are the best, the most efficient, and least expensive rocket engines in the world. And we have become somewhat dependent on them to get our national security payloads into space, and not just our national security payloads, but also civil payloads. As I said, satellites that get our GPS systems up there, and systems that control ATMs, systems that control a whole lot of things, cell phones that we take for granted, would not be up there without these Russian rockets. It's not to say that we cannot develop our own rocket engines to power. The rockets are made in the United States. The engines come from Russia.
I see.
We could make our own engines, but we have not developed them, and it would take us a little bit of time, at least 5 years, to get up and running.
Have there been threats from the Russians at any time? Because our relationship with them has been uneasy at best for the past 10 years, probably. Have there been threats before that they would pull the plug on these engines?
Well, there was a suggestion in August when, as you may remember, there was a lot of tension over Syria. The United States was contemplating military action, strikes against the Assad regime. And Syria, the government is backed by Russia. And there were rumors from Russia. There were reports that the government was planning on pulling the plug on these engines, these rocket engines. And there was quite a bit of distress in the U.S. space industry over this.
Mm-hmm. The engines are also used, and there were just people launched to the space station just at the end of March, weren't there? Don't they power the launch vehicles that are used to get us to the space station?
Well, not these specific engines. The U.S. is entirely dependent on the Russians to get our astronauts to the space station. We scrapped the shuttle a few years ago, and we rely on Soyuz capsules. These are Russian space capsules to ferry astronauts to and from the space station. So that's a separate issue. But in that, we have no other options. We can only get to the space station on Soyuz capsules.
Mm-hmm. And the number of satellites that are launched where we do use the engines, it's a fairly substantial number, isn't it?
Well, it doesn't sound all that significant. It's about 8 or 9 a year. But the types of payloads that these rockets and the rocket engines are carrying are quite significant.
You write, over the next 24 months, that Atlas V will be used to launch 4 classified spy satellites for the National Reconnaissance Office, 1 unclassified imagery satellite, 2 weather satellites, 4 GPS satellites, 3 military communication satellites, 2 classified payloads for the Air Force, and 1 NASA science satellite. That's quite a few.
That is quite a few. Altogether, it's about 17, I think.
Hmm. Well, wouldn't the Russians have questions, considering what our relationship is, and particularly since the Ukraine problems that we've been protesting, carrying one of our unclassified imagery satellites up there? I mean, we could be using it to look at what they're doing, right?
Well, certainly. And I think that these questions are being asked in Russia, and there may very well be hints or threats or whatever you want to call it to suspend this program of furnishing these rocket engines. There is a slight problem in that the enterprise that makes the engines has no other customers, so it would put quite a crimp in their enterprise if they stopped selling to us.
Yeah. Tell me a bit more about why the Russians, you say that they have accomplished a heck of a lot in space. We knew we could learn from their capabilities. Why did they keep going forward with all of this when we've been cutting back?
Well, this goes back many, many years. It's something that Americans don't like to hear, but we are far from the forefront of science and technology in terms of education and in terms of achievement. Russia, and before that the Soviet Union, was way ahead of us in achievements in math, science, and all of those areas. So there were some technological issues with Russian space industry and other areas. But in terms of the theory, in terms of what they were able to develop, they were on the forefront. They were on the cutting edge. This was easily accomplished in the Soviet Union when the state could just dictate that all of the resources of
right.
the state could be put at the disposition of whatever area it wanted. It did not have to balance the bottom line. Now it's a little bit more problematical, and money that they can get or revenue that they can get from selling things to the West and to the United States is important.
Do you imagine, as they are looking at our sanctions on them over Ukraine, that they are looking, you talk about they're not going to lie down over all this. Do you think that they are actively thinking about punishing us when it comes to what you just outlined?
Well, I would imagine that they are. I can't imagine that they would not be. I think there is some reluctance on both sides to escalate the situation. We have said that we are contemplating more aggressive sanctions, but so far we have not instituted them. And the sanctions that we have put into place are they are significant in some ways, but really they're not expected to cripple the Russian economy in any really major way. So I think as we contemplate firmer sanctions or more aggressive measures, the Russians will be doing the same thing.
You probably heard the news from NPR at the top of the hour. Riot police, other Ukrainian forces cracking down on pro-Russian demonstrators in eastern Ukraine, warning from neighboring Russia that they were alleging an American military contractor is helping Ukraine. Do you know more about that story?
I don't know much more about the background of that. I have seen that the contractor has said that this is not true, that this they have not provided any aid to Ukraine. But Russia or other countries often seize on information and blow it a little bit out of proportion in order to accomplish their own PR or propaganda goals.
Mm-hmm. So do the Russians really have a monopoly on this engine that is needed to accomplish what the United States needs to accomplish? Or are there other countries that we could go to get what we need?
Oh, well, that particular engine comes only from Russia.
Really?
Yeah. We do have things that could be substituted for the RD-180, the engine that we're buying from Russia. But it would take a while to ramp up production on our end. I think that there is a push on to do that, especially with these tensions that have been increasing for the past month or so. And they'll be looking into, the Pentagon is looking into this, the government in general is looking into how we became so dependent on Russia. But they will be trying to ramp up production of our own engines that can take over.
And who's pushing the hardest, the military?
Well, the Pentagon, and also contractors that are such as SpaceX that are trying to compete with Lockheed and Boeing and those who are currently contracting to NASA and to the military.
Mm-hmm. Isn't it unusual, Gene, for us to have this kind of dependence with a country that we had a long Cold War with? Did we think everything was just going to go along swimmingly after that was over?
I think that I spent all of the 90s in Russia, and it was quite astounding. It seemed that as soon as the Soviet government toppled, the United States was quite ready to think that everything was going to now be normal, that Russia would become, if not our best friend forever, but at least a very good friend, thinking that the problem was all in the Soviet system of government and not in the country itself. And things have not really turned out quite that way. It seems that there are some problems or tensions with Russia that cannot be solved by a change of government.
Mm-hmm. And did we see those beginning with Putin in 2000?
I think, yes, shortly after Putin took over from Boris Yeltsin. Yeltsin was quite well thought of in the United States, probably much more highly thought of than he should have been, given what he was actually doing during his reign. But we were, I think, much more prepared to look the other way while Yeltsin was president than we were when Putin took over.
We are going to welcome phone calls for our guest. Gene McKenzie is our guest, senior correspondent for Global Post, formerly based in Kabul, Afghanistan. As you heard her say, she spent a number of years, the decade of the 90s, in Moscow, where she worked for a number of newspapers. She was program director for the Institute for War and Peace, reporting from Kabul, and now working as a journalist, trainer, and a consultant. She's done many projects and analysis for a number of broadcast outlets, NPR, Canadian Broadcasting, CNN, Australian Broadcasting. We can go in several directions here. Perhaps it's not news to you. It was news to me, our dependence on Russia for the engines that power the rockets that deliver military and civilian payloads into space. And as she writes, they could use this as a bargaining chip as our relationship over Ukraine sours, and they perhaps decide they're going to take action in response to our sanctions. Those engines help power the rockets that give us our GPA systems in cars and cell phones, even systems, she writes, that allow ATMs to function. Our weather satellites are launched into space via these Russian-powered rockets. And our military systems, such as early missile detection, also depend on our, we could probably put this in quotation marks at the moment, friends in Moscow. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. Lines are open for you right now, 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@WPR.org. Our Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter, and you can reach us there, @KDunnShow. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. All right, we go to phone calls now, 800-486-8655. Gene McKenzie is our guest, and let's go to Hugh in Green Bay. Hi, Hugh.
Hello.
Hi, go right ahead, sir.
There's a outfit in California that makes Tesla cars. It's an electric car, and one of the things that he has been doing is building rockets to put things into outer space. And they're from California. And I think he's bidding on a contract with the government to use his rockets.
Uh-huh.
So what's going on there?
What's going on there, Gene?
Well, the payloads that we are launching into space are configured specifically for certain rockets, which are configured specifically to work with certain engines. So now that things are going a bit haywire with Russia, we are looking into other options. But it's not as simple as just buying another engine or buying another rocket. These things are very technologically complex and will have to be reconfigured to work with other systems. And that's what's going on now. We have maybe a five-year lag time before we can have these other systems up and running.
5 years? That's a long time.
Well, yes, it is quite complex. And they have to be tested. They have to be designed. They have to be tested, and then production has got to be ramped up so that we have enough production capacity to handle all of the payloads that we need to get into space on a yearly basis.
Well, considering all of the important things that these engines are used for, which we've outlined during this show, it's hard to believe that the U.S. didn't decide a long time ago that we should be making, I mean, we have smart people here, that we shouldn't be making the engines ourselves. Why haven't we?
Well, that is a good question, and it's a good question for the Secretary of Defense. And when Chuck Hagel was in front of a congressional committee about a month ago, he was taking tough questions on this very issue. And his response was, yes, we are aware of the situation, and we are looking into the situation. So as to why it didn't happen before, that's something that the Pentagon would have to answer. But my understanding is that they now are trying to handle the situation.
Mm-hmm. Could that be expedited, do you think, 5-year lag time?
Well, it just depends on how much money they are going to be able to throw at it. As you know, this is not a very good time for our defense budget. But in any case, the technological complexity is such that it can be expedited somewhat if there's will and a lot of money. But there is a lag time that cannot be expedited. So the smallest length of time I've heard is 3 years. So we're talking 3 to 5 years.
Thanks, Hugh, for your call. Earl in Medford is next. Hi, Earl.
Hello.
Hi, Earl.
Hello.
Yes, go ahead, sir.
Yes, I understand we have a growing private sector in the U.S. For rocket science, and that, like the SpaceX Corporation and that. Aren't they helping us in that regard?
Well, SpaceX would very much like to be helping us in that regard. And the head of SpaceX, Elon Musk, also testified before Congress, and he is making a bid for military contracting for to get some of the business that's now being given to this United Launch Alliance, which is Lockheed Martin and Boeing, in partnership with the Russians. The problem, as I've said, is that these systems are quite finicky and quite technologically complex. And so if he were to be given a contract, it would still take a certain number of years in order for him to be able to step in where the Russian company is now.
You quoted him in your article. He was evidently testifying before Congress and
right.
found, of course, the right moment here in light of Russia's de facto annexation of Ukraine's Crimea region and the formal severing of military ties. The Atlas V cannot possibly be described as providing assured access to space for our nation when the supply of the main engine depends on Putin's permission.
Right. And he is offering his Falcon rockets as a replacement, but this is going to require not only reconfiguring the rockets, but also adapting the rocket engines so that they can be used with specific payloads. So it's just not a simple matter
right.
of identifying the problem. I think the problem has now been identified adequately. It's just the time for addressing the problem is needed.
Mm-hmm. And he said in the same testimony, you say, that he could provide high reliability at much lower cost. What makes him say that?
He's trying to get a contract.
Right, right.
this is what we do. From people I've talked to in the space industry, they say that the Falcon has a few problems, that it is a little temperamental and would have to be adapted. So whatever Musk is promising at this point, it remains to be seen whether the Falcon can handle the payloads and whether it can be adequately adapted for the rockets.
Mm-hmm. And how much are one of these engines, did you say?
We don't really know. It's proprietary information. But the estimates are 11 to 15, 11 to $15 million per. So we're not, it's not a ton of money, but it's developing the enterprise, the factories, the equipments that are going to be able to make them.
And why would that be proprietary information? It's our money, isn't it?
It is our money. It's proprietary information with the American companies who are working with the Russian enterprise, and they are not divulging that information.
Mm-hmm. Do you know, are there other such collaborations here or other dependencies that we have on Russia?
Well, I'm sure that there are. I don't think they've all been brought to light. But we've had a fairly cooperative relationship with Russia over the past decade. I know that in the minds of many of us, the legacy of the Cold War is such that it's difficult to look at Russia as a friend and ally. But Russia has worked with us on the war in Afghanistan, has made supply routes available. Ukraine actually had some forces in the alliance fighting in Afghanistan. And we really have developed a fairly cooperative relationship. The fact that that is now endangered and the relationship is bringing up a whole lot of associations that are reminiscent of the 80s, I think is a function of our past history. But if we look at just what we've been doing in the past 10 to 15 years, it has been a pretty good pretty good relationship. Where all of those areas of dependency are, I think, remains to be seen as these sanctions escalate and we institute one measure and they reply and we retaliate and they retaliate.
Right.
As it escalates, I think we're going to come to see that there are other areas where we are vulnerable.
And what about the Russians? Are they dependent on us?
Probably much to a lesser extent. Putin has made self-reliance a cornerstone of his philosophy. And Russians in general, I think, are more used to making do or used to privation, much more so than the United States. What I'm hearing from my friends in Russia are that these sanctions are actually rallying the Russians behind Putin, that it's playing on old Russian fears of being looked down on by the West or being threatened by the West. And even Russians who are quite critical of Putin and dislike him quite intensely are rallying behind him because the nation is in need. So we may find that our attempts to weaken Putin are actually making him stronger, ironically.
Mm. Earl, did that satisfy your question, or did you have something else? Okay, Earl's gone. Sorry, I should have gone back to you earlier, Earl. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. And in case you're wondering what we're talking about, it's a new area to be concerned about as tensions between the United States and Russia become more and more strained. We rely on Russian rocket engines, the best in the world, our guest writes, and we use them for all kinds of things that are important to our everyday lives. The engines that the rockets that are used to go into space that are used for our GPS systems in our cars, cell phones, the systems that even allow your ATM to work. Weather satellites are launched into space via these Russian-powered rockets. And military systems, early missile detection, also depend on these. So the thrust of the conversation is, as he is deploring the sanctions that we've placed on him, what is it that Russia could do to hurt us? And this is an area that would indeed, because we're not capable of designing these engines or building them ourselves and probably won't be at the earliest for 3 years. So what do you think? Were you aware of this collaboration? Do you think it was wise? Do you think that we need to start doing this on our own, even if it's 3 years? Does it make a difference in terms of the kinds of sanctions that we can level on Russia? Our phone number is 800-486-8655. Email talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, and we're also on Twitter @KDunnShow. And Jean McKenzie is our guest, who wrote a piece about this for Global Post picked up by Salon that looks at this very issue, how Russia could strangle the U.S. space program. Let's spend just a few minutes, Jean, talking about the space station. I mentioned earlier about the two Russian astronauts and one American astronaut heading for the International Space Station that just happened at the end of March. There they are together on a six-hour, pretty extraordinary journey, and they're going to be up there for a long period of time. You have to wonder if politics plays into that at all. Do you think on all this time they're spending together, if they can speak to each other, if they're talking about all of this, don't you think it would make them a little nervous?
From what I hear, I don't think so. I think that their focus is on their projects, on the science, and that they are not spending an awful lot of time on political discussions while they're up there in space. And keep in mind that once they're up there, the U.S. Astronauts can't get home without
right.
the Russian space capsule.
Exactly.
So I think there is quite a bit of pressure to, and they're in very confined quarters. I think there's a lot of pressure to be cooperative and not to engage in discussions that don't have any easy answers.
Are you aware of when that collaboration started?
I am not. I believe that we've been collaborating on the space, I don't know exactly, on the space station for quite some time, but the collaboration on getting our astronauts there began when we scrapped the shuttle mission, whenever that was, 2 or 3 years ago.
Let's go to Leah in Green Bay next. Hi, Leah.
Hi. Well, you asked the question if you thought that it was wise to have that relationship with Russia and treat them as if they weren't our enemies anymore. And, you know, we're always taught that you should treat people the way you want them to behave. So if we trusted them and treated them as if we trusted them, things should have gone well. And the other part that I want to say is we also have this movement in our country not to spend government, not to spend money, not to have a big government. And so the whole space program was kind of sent into oblivion. So it was convenient for us to use their things. So I think, you know, we have no one to blame but ourselves in some ways, if you want to call it blame.
Mm-hmm. What do you think, Jean?
Well, I think that that's a very good point. We do have no one to blame but ourselves. It's not as if Russia forced this dependency on us or this cooperation on the space station. These were all functions of decisions made by our own government. And I think that that we did try to forge a more cooperative relationship with Russia, but there are tensions that are going to be inherent in the whole geopolitical situation right now in the globe. And with Ukraine, with Crimea, with the economic forces at work with the European Union and Ukraine, these are tensions that cannot be smoothed over, I think, just with kind words and good behavior. They are real tensions that are going to have to be addressed.
Mm-hmm. Do you know if there was any kind of presidential initiative on this? Was it a President Bill Clinton who, as a goodwill gesture, said we realize that big changes have happened in the Soviet Union and we want to help you out, and here's one substantial way that we'll show our goodwill and we'll also help you economically, and that's to hand over the engines construction to the Russians?
Oh, well, I think that there was benefit on both sides. It's yes, we did invest, if you want to put it that way. We invested a lot of money in Russia in the 90s. We were sending experts. We were opening NGOs. We were exporting know-how and trying to help Russia get on its feet. But Russia is a very large and a very large country that's very rich in resources, and it very quickly adapted to the world economy and really didn't need the kind of assistance that we were providing. Mm-hmm. I think that the cooperation on the space program was of benefit to both sides. It helped to keep some money flowing into Russian space industry in the 90s, but we also acquired a lot of technological know-how at pretty rock-bottom prices.
Mm-hmm. Larry and Sullivan is next. Thank you, Leah, for your call. Hi, Larry.
Hello. I think the people would be somewhat set back if they realized how much some critical industries that we depend on, not only Russia, but China and other countries that we, you know, if we ever had a real knockdown, drag-out confrontation, we would be sorely outmanned. not necessarily outmanned, but we don't have the technology industries in this country that we had many years ago. And it started with Russia falling, but China also holds a lot of our, not only our paper, but also our technology, and supplies us with all the footwear or the large portion of it for our military. That's all I got to say.
All right. Thanks for the call, Gene.
Well, it certainly is true that we have outsourced an awful lot of technology, and we do rely on China especially for quite a bit of of technology that powers our military. I think the thinking, I don't know, I'm not at that level of policy, but I think that the thinking was that economic cooperation would foster foster more friendly relations and would make the likelihood of a knockdown, drag-out conflict less likely. And I think we're still hoping that will be the case and that we can reinstitute some sort of cooperation with Russia.
Hmm. Do you have, you understand what's going on in Russia because you lived there for so long, more than any of us. Do you, let me ask a question that may be very hard to answer, but we're trying to figure out here what Vladimir Putin's grand design is. What's he doing? Do we know?
Well, I think that comparisons to Hitler or predictions that Putin is trying to reconstitute the Soviet Union are a little bit overblown. But what is undeniable is that Russia is a very large and on the European side, flat country with no natural barriers between it and the rest of Europe. It has historically looked for buffer zones. It has historically wanted other countries between it and possible invaders. And you know, let's not forget that that Germany was right there and caused incredible destruction in Russia and Ukraine and Belarus and those countries during World War II. So Russia has a historical paranoia, if you will, or a threat, maybe not paranoia if it actually happened, but a fear of invasion and a fear of exposure. I don't see any circumstances in which any president, not just Putin, but any president in Moscow would allow Ukraine to join NATO or Belarus. Or any of the republics that border on the rest of Europe. It's just too big a risk in their minds for them to take. Given that and the close historical ties between Russia and Ukraine, it's not hard to see how this happened. Ukraine has been very resentful of Russia's influence for centuries now, and Ukraine kind of came together from different different ethnic groups in different geographical areas and really is a country with a great big fault line in it. So what we're seeing is that fault line giving way under pressure from Europe and the United States on the one hand and Moscow on the other.
And the risk for Russia in allowing joining with NATO would be what? What are they worried about?
They are worried about NATO was formed, don't forget, to counter the Soviet Union. It was formed as an answer to the Soviet Union. They would not want NATO in Ukraine any more than we wanted Soviet missiles in Cuba way back in 1961.
Oh, that's a strong statement, yeah.
So it's fine to argue that we're all friends now and the Cold War is over, but just as we have a historical memory or historical reaction, really, to any mention of supposed Russian aggression, they are going to have the same kind of historical memory and historical reaction to any threats of NATO coming right up to their border.
Mm-hmm. Larry, thanks for your call. Mohammed in Milwaukee. Hi, Mohammed.
Yes, hi. My question is, or my comment and question is that, why don't the United Nations convene a conference to deal with all these minority situations around the world? Because you have countries like Congo, like Rwanda, China, Burma, Soviet Union, Ukraine. All these countries have minorities, and they are not happy with the system as is. It's not like in the United States we have minorities, but they are happy because they are satisfied, they have freedom, they have enough food, everything. They don't want to split. But in other parts of the world, they are not happy. Maybe the United Nations should take the initiative and really, you know, remap the countries of the world.
Well, it's a great thought. It's just... I think that the United Nations maybe does not have the clout in the world that it used to have, or that we wish it would have. It's been involved in a lot of endless and fruitless conflicts over the past past couple of decades. It would be great if they would have a conference, but how much that conference could accomplish is an open question.
Thanks, Mohammed, for your call. We'll take more of them in just one moment. Jean McKenzie is our guest. She wrote an article that was picked up by Salon that caught our attention, and it is titled How Russia Could Strangle the U.S. Space Program. If you use a cell phone, have a GPS system in your car, or get cash from ATMs, you should be worried. Think Russia has no way to put pressure on the United States? Think again. 800-486-8655, email talk at WPR.org, Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show, Twitter is at K Dunn Show, and this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's go back to phone calls and to Bob in Madison next. Hi, Bob.
Yes, hello. I've had a lifelong appreciation for Russian culture, and I'm just curious is what drew your guest to spend so much time in Russia. And I was wondering, what was the ways that her experience in Russia, she became disenchanted with her initial desire to go to Russia, and what ways was her initial love for Russia affirmed?
Oh, goodness. Well, I took a course my senior year of college because it was a good time slot called Russian Intellectual History, in which I had absolutely no interest. And halfway through the first semester, I was hooked.
Really?
I would have to say Pushkin, Dostoevsky, Tolstoy, you name it. I made it my life's work to learn the language so I could read those texts in the original. And I wouldn't say I was disenchanted. I don't think, I think that the Russophiles among us who lived in the Soviet Union were under no illusions about the system and the government. It was not a pleasant place to be. It was not a pleasant place to live. And it was tremendously exciting in the 90s when everything seemed possible and everything was opening up. I think it's not that I was disenchanted so much with Russia as just exhausted by all of the upheavals that happened through the 90s. I'd very happily go back, but from what I understand now, Moscow is one of the most expensive cities on the face of the planet.
Is it?
Yes. When I lived there in the 90s, in the early 90s, you could get by on $200 or $300 a month. Now I think you'd need that for lunch. So I'd be happy to go back to Moscow, but it's quite a different place, certainly, than it was. And I think what we found is that a lot of the problems that we ascribed to the Soviet system of government were really inherent to Russia and to Russia's worldview, and that it was not so easy to divorce the country from the system of government. The Soviet system of government was instituted and perpetrated by Russians, and there is a type of authoritarianism, and there is a type of maximalism, if you will, that is inherent to Russia and always will be there, whether the system is capitalism or communism or anything else that they might come along with.
Thanks, Bob, for your call. Mike in Racine, hello.
Hi. I just, I know it wasn't explicitly stated, but earlier when you were talking about kind of why did we get to where we got on the space program is, I just want to remind people that this was a time when there was a tremendous worry, and I think it was a justified worry, that if the rocket industry and some of the munitions industries and so forth didn't have a continuous flow of income and could support their own workers, that there was a very good probability that the most talented with the best skills were going to be bought at the highest bidding by places like North Korea and Iran and Iraq at the time. Remember, that's in the 90s. And that those people had all the knowledge and capability to know how to build intercontinental ballistic missiles and put nuclear warheads on top of them.
Mm-hmm. That is absolutely true. It's an excellent point, and I think that we were very well aware of that, and that there were explicit programs in place in the 90s to keep Soviet or ex-Soviet Russian scientists as happy and productively engaged as possible to avert that very risk that they might be tempted to go elsewhere and put their skills to uses that we would find very alarming.
Did some of them leave anyway?
I'm sure that they did. They're not. This is not something that's widely talked about. But we haven't seen real evidence of this.
Anything else, Mike? All right. Thanks very much for your call, Jerry in Onalaska. Hi.
Hi. Yeah, that was a very good point. But my point is that I think Russia is not a really, really big economy. I think California's economy is bigger than Russia. I think they get a lot more headlines because they used to be the head of the Soviet Union and they no longer are. They're not as important, I think, in the world as they used to be, of course. And we don't not, I don't think, except for this last point, we don't have to buy from Russia. In fact, it might help us get some jobs to create those missiles here, those engines here. I think that's not a warlike activity, not buying from someone. It's like, choosing one grocery store over another. Just choose not to buy from them. I think it would, remember, we can make a lot of excuses about their history and about their culture, but, they did, you might say, invade and take over a separate country, a different country, just like, of course, Germany did to Austria. And it is similar to that in that way. And now they're threatening to take over another part of that country. I mean, we can say about their history and so forth, but nevertheless, they did do that.
What do we do
is right.
If we don't have the engines and it would take us 3 years to build them, how do we handle that gap, do you think, Jerry?
Well, I'm hoping we have a couple of engines we can maybe repair. Let's hope.
Okay. What do you say to that, Gene?
Well, there is certainly no necessity to buy from Russia once we have developed a domestic capability. I think that's what people are looking at now. And Russia certainly is not the superpower that the Soviet Union was. But we shouldn't try to belittle it too much. It is still the world's largest country and has enormous resources that will keep it going for quite a while.
Mm-hmm. And how do you think we're going to work out this engine thing?
I think that judging by what the Secretary of Defense said, they are looking into adapting. There's a Delta IV rocket that can be adapted for use again with a couple of years and a couple of $1 billion to fund the research, but it can be adapted for use. These problems are not unsolvable. They certainly can be solved, but it's going to take time, determination, and money. And it's what do we do in the meantime? I assume that we're not going to do without cell phones or GPS for a couple of years while we're developing our own capabilities.
Right. Where do you live now, Jean?
I'm in Massachusetts, near Cape Cod.
You have been all over the place, haven't you?
I certainly have.
Yeah. Thank you ever so much for being with us. It was a really interesting conversation, and you made us think about things that we don't normally think about, which is good. Thanks.
Oh, well, thank you, Kathleen. My pleasure.
Jean McKenzie, senior correspondent for Global Post, her piece that we've been talking about and that prompted this conversation is in Ceylon. She has been based in Kabul, Afghanistan for a long time. She was program director for the Institute for War and Peace Reporting. She's now working as a journalist, trainer, and a consultant, and she lived in Moscow for 10 years, long period of time in the 90s, starting her career as a journalist with the Moscow Times and working for a number of papers, Christian Science Monitor, Newsday, and the Boston Globe. Thanks to Judith Sears-Poisson for producing hosting this hour, and thanks to KP Whaley for on-air production in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee. We have news coming up momentarily from National Public Radio, and then we will return and talk about who the people are on this planet who are living on a dollar a day or less. Stay tuned.